I'm JJ.
I'm Dan.
I'm Martin.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles.
Welcome to the Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast about impossible crime fiction. Today, we are very excited to be in the conference centre of the British Library as we've been attending the Bodies from the Library conference, which is a wonderful golden age detective fiction, very geeky day full of lots of laughs, lots of great books and a huge amount of knowledge input. And we've got a very special guest on the show today at the end of this conference.
We thought we'd mix things up a bit because ordinarily you have to listen to myself and Dan talking about things from a position of quite astounding ignorance. So today we have an expert with us. I legitimately cannot believe we're doing this. We are delighted to welcome to the podcast Mr. Martin Edwards. Welcome, sir.
Great to be with you.
It really is lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. As we know, it's been a busy and a long day for everybody, so hopefully we'll get through this reasonably intelligently. But if not, don't worry, because the standard is not very high, so it's absolutely fine. On the off chance that the kind of people who frequent Golden Age Detective Fiction blogs and are listening to Golden Age Detective Fiction and Impossible Crime focused podcasts are unaware of yourself and your current works, would you be so kind as to give us an introduction to yourself and your current role inside of the GAD sphere?
Well, there is a reason why my blog, which I started just over 10 years ago, is called Do You Write Under Your Own Name? Because it's a question I've often been asked. And really, it's a very polite way of people saying, I've never actually heard of me. So that's my experience of 20-odd years as a writer. I'm first and foremost a novelist. Writing crime novels is what I always wanted to do. It's taken me a long time to get to the point of doing it more or less full-time, but I've finally just about got there. But I've always been a crime fan and a crime reader, and I've read all kinds of crime fiction, but I began with Agatha Christie and Sherlock Holmes, and I've always retained great enthusiasm for those wonderful stories. And really, it was Christie in particular that fired my desire to become a crime novelist and to write originally whodunits. And I kept reading Christie, and when I finished with all the books that Christie had written, I moved on to other Golden Age writers. So I read Sayers, Marsh, Tay, and Mitchell, but then I moved on to some of the more obscure writers who, as I was growing up, books were very hard to find because they were out of print. Mm. So I used to haunt second-hand bookshops, and in more recent times I've started to write about them. And so I wrote a book called The Golden Age of Murder, which was an examination of the detective story in the 1930s from the angle of looking at people who are members of the Detection Club. And I followed it up more recently with a book for the British Library as a companion to the Classic Crime series called The Story of Classic Crime in 100 Books.
You're very modestly failing to mention the superb work you're doing as well as an anthologist for the British Library Crime Classic, but also additionally on top of that, the fact that you are not just a member of the Detection Club, not just the fact that you were the first archivist of the Detection Club, but you are now the president of the Detection Club. And obviously on the back of this, you have a tremendous overview, a tremendous authority in terms of understanding the history of the genre. Is that something you'd think you can expand upon at all?
Well, it seemed to me always, I was working as a lawyer as well as writing for many years, and I found when I started publishing crime fiction that I got to know fellow crime writers, initially through the Crime Writers Association, and a social network of crime writers was very supportive, and it's been a great benefit to me in my career as a writer and in my life, really. Most of my friends are connected with crime writing, and if not for actually fellow crime writers. So it's been really important to me to, in more recent years, as I've had a little bit more time, not working full time as a lawyer anymore, to contribute a bit to keeping the Detection Club and also the Crime Writers Association moving forward, making sure that they remain as supportive to other members as they have been to me, and that is what I see as my role as president of the Detection Club in particular, to keep alive and in a thriving state the oldest social network for crime writers anywhere in the world.
A huge amount of that, I imagine, comes from then things like the event we've had today, because part of what is going to keep those networks alive is there being a demand for that sort of books, and so generating interest through a lot of this sort of public engagement.
Well, I think certainly with the heritage of crime fiction and the revival in recent years of interest in Golden Age fiction in particular, over, let's say, the last 5 years, British Library's done great work with the Crime Classics series. I'm very proud to be a consultant to that project. But also, I think that the enthusiasm that you find that was just you felt 10 years, 15 years ago, I felt that not many other people shared my enthusiasm for these books. Now you come to something like Bodies from the Library, and it's quite evident that 200-odd people have come down to London today to share in that enthusiasm. And that's really exciting. And there's another event which I'm closely involved with called Alibis in the Archives, which will be held again next year. And that's at Gladstone's Library, near Chester, a little village called Harden, just over the North Wales border. And that's the place where, as archivist of the Detection Club and the Crime Writers Association, I've arranged for the archives of both, under the name of the British Crime Writing Archives, to be held. And the Alibis weekend is a weekend of events and talks and associated entertainments, all connected with the heritage of crime fiction. They've both been sellouts, and that too is really exciting.
It must be interesting on a kind of level of raw passion and emotion, like you were saying, to feel sort of isolated in your genre. But now also, I just imagine, you know, you, as you're saying, as a young reader of Christie, and now you're the president of the Detection Club. I mean, how does that feel, like being part of that and also seeing something like today where there's so many people coming along?
Well, it's so exciting. It is still quite hard. I do have to pinch myself from time to time to believe it's actually happened. The last few years, although I've been, as I mentioned, writing for a long, long time, it's really only the last 4 or 5 years that, on a personal level, my books, fiction and non-fiction, have broken through to some extent. And that's been exciting. And travelling the world, as I have done in the last couple of years in particular, talking about my fiction, but also about Golden Age fiction, in a whole variety of places I would never have dreamed of visiting, let alone speaking about my passion, in places like Dubai and New Orleans, Hawaii, Toronto.
It's all those
incredible.
Classic crime locations.
Who thought it?
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I think what's great about this is it's something that is really fed by the growth in social media, and just in terms of the awareness of this, because you talk a lot about feeling isolated in your reading, you know, and people would have done 30, 40 years ago. Yeah. And now there is a tremendous growth with, you mentioned your blog, for instance. Yeah. I know you're very active on Twitter. You've been kind enough to reply to some of my really annoying questions on Twitter, for which I'd like to now apologise in person.
What do you eat for breakfast? All those kind of
Thankfully,
things.
It was merely to do with the exact publication date of Rupert Penny.
That is awful.
A mere trifle. Which
yeah.
Might be the trifle's what you have for breakfast, actually. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's lovely to see that, although there is this kind of slightly fusty sense of what the classic detection represents, the fact that actually it's using a lot of the more modern sort of means of spreading the word to get out and to, you know, so that people in Dubai or in Hawaii, as you say, are aware that these things are happening.
Well, that's absolutely right. And it is through blogging in particular that I began to encounter people in different parts of the world. My blog's been running since 2007, so quite a while. And that's opened my eyes, and also as someone who's been trying to track down these rare books for a long time.
Yeah.
Sadly, secondhand bookshops are not as easy to find as they used to be, but at least through the internet you can track down all sorts of rare titles, and the real dilemma now is, can I afford to buy them?
Yeah, exactly. I guess it's interesting in the kind of circular way. There was one talk today which was a very humorous talk looking at the kind of the rise and fall of, and the rise again of Golden Age detective fiction. And maybe there's a link between, as you were saying, JJ, about the link between social media and the development of the internet and further development of technology with the rise of a genre that's fallen and risen again. And it's quite interesting seeing a loop where a genre that is as we heard a lot about today, so much involved in, say, the newspapers or something that would be shared between people, and then sort of seeing it happen again through blogs, and that's quite interesting, the sort of circular motion of the genre.
Yes, it is. And of course, there's fashion in everything. There's fashion in fiction as well as everything else. Mm. So to some extent, I think that there's an element of fashion. But I think you're absolutely right that these ways of making connections between people with enthusiasms all over the world is something that would have been unthinkable when I was growing up, and it's really rather wonderful.
I just love the idea that, as you talk about fashion, although this is growing, that crime fiction, detective fiction in particular, has always been a little bit on the fringes. Has always been seen as uncouth and unfashionable. And I'm happy that I'm into something that has always been deemed as unfashionable. I kind of think that makes me a little bit cooler. Do you know what I mean?
It's because you're so cool in every other regard.
Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah.
This is the only uncool thing you do.
I've got to balance it out somehow.
Yeah.
So, of course, this is a podcast about impossible crime fiction. We have your encyclopedic mind of Golden Age detective fiction. And, of course, you've read a lot of impossible crimes and written them as well yourself. And, of course, one thing we've been seeing here through this conference today is all the work on your anthologies, particularly those for the British Library. So a great one you did recently was the Miraculous Mysteries Collection, which is a collection of Locked Room short stories, which if our listeners haven't read, go and buy it. It's brilliant. And then, of course, you talk about a lot of impossible crimes in the story of classic crime in 100 books. There's a lot of the big names, big hitters in there. We've got Calm, Jack Futrelle, Mystery in the Yellow Room, all those things, Rawson. But it'd be interesting to talk about some of the more obscure Locked Room choices, why you chose them and how you came across them.
Yes, well, one of the things that always appeals to me about, when writing a book or putting an anthology together is to have a blend and variety. And if you always go to the familiar, to me it's a little bit less interesting than if you have a mix. And so with an anthology, I would like to have some of the better-known writers, better-known stories perhaps, but also some of those that are rather less well-known and some of the most obscure stories sometimes that you can possibly find. And that to me is great fun because it's a way of introducing the reader of the anthology to a whole host of writers and certainly stories that they may never have encountered. You might lure them in with the promise of a John Dixon Carr short story or something like that, but they might find there's something by Christopher St. John Sprigg that they hadn't expected.
Can I just stop you there? Is it authoritatively Christopher St. John Sprigg or is it Christopher St. John Sprigg?
I have absolutely no idea.
But we thought we were going to bring the definitive.
Yeah. I've been asking for, ever since Death of an Airman, right? I've been asking. No one knows.
Tweeting you every day. What's the correct pronunciation?
It's a Northern guy's pronunciation.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. Cool. I mean, Murder of a Lady by Anthony Wynne is one that you mention in the classic crime books, which is obviously one that was also produced in the British Library Crime Classics series.
Yeah.
I'm just interested, is there anything you think worth sharing about some of the books that are not so easily found? Some of the books you particularly mention, or are there authors that you would like there to be more awareness of? Because obviously you picked these books because you feel they contribute to the development of the genre. These are not necessarily the best books, you're very clear on that. Are there obscure authors, therefore, who are writing these impossible crimes who you think there should be a greater awareness around?
Well, there are quite a few, actually, and you're absolutely right. The concept of the book was not to give just a shopping list of my favourites or what someone might think are the 100 best books. It was rather to tell a story and to tell a story about the evolution of the genre over the first half of last century, but also to pick up particular topics and the Locked Room mysteries, of course, as with you guys, something I've been very keen on for many, many years. And with the section on Locked Room mysteries, again, as with the Miraculous Mysteries anthology, I was looking to deal with both the familiar and with the less familiar, so John Dixon Carr's The Hollow Man, Cheesy classic.
Say that again. The Hollow. Sorry.
Anthony Wynne. I was keen that the library should include that particular book in the crime classic series. It came out a couple of years ago because it strikes me as a very good example of the genre. And I think until then, Anthony Wynne had been out of print for a very, very long time. And he is a variable writer, there's no doubt about it. But that's a book that I think is really very successful indeed. And in the section in the book, dealing with lottery mysteries, having covered that one and Carr, of course, as well as a general introduction, I focused on a book that was recommended to me many years ago by the late Bob Adey, who was the ultimate aficionado of lottery and murders. Lottery Mysteries, and wrote a great book about them. And Bob recommended me to read a writer called George Limnelius, which was a pseudonym for a chap called Lewis Robinson, Major Lewis Robinson, in fact. He lived certainly later life in the Wrexham area of North Wales, and he wrote a handful of books, occasionally under his own name, sometimes under that pen name of Limnelius. And all his books are interesting, but the Medbury Fort Murder, which is the book that Bob recommended to me, was one that really impressed me. And when I go back to it, it continues to impress me as a very, very strong example, not only of a good lottery mystery, which pays due respect to some of the early classics that preceded it, but also it's a very well-written book, and it gives you a very good setting in this sort of strange fort in the middle of the water. And also the characters are perhaps, I think, better defined than you often find in Golden Age mysteries. So it's got the lot, really. It's got an interesting setting, good characters, and a very strong mystery. So it's a book that really does deserve, I think, to become much better known. So of course, as a writer, writer of fiction myself, I have a lot of empathy for those writers who've disappeared into obscurity, because that tends to be our fate. it's the fate of writers generally, I think. Very few writers of the past have remained household names. Statistically, that's I think beyond dispute. So I've always sympathised with those who wrote good books and have been forgotten. I sympathise with those who've written okay books and have been forgotten.
Yeah, sure. It's a bold and brave task to write, isn't it? So with that in mind, obviously you chose these books, like you say, to tell a story, but personally for you, what do you think, as a writer in yourself, having written some lottery dreams, having read a lot and having anthologised a lot, what makes for you a great lottery mystery or impossible crime?
I think there are a number of ingredients to a good lottery mystery. Clearly in a novel, you want the blend of character and setting and the puzzle plot. The plot's got to make sense. I felt in my own writing that impossible crime stories work better for me as short stories. I've written three over the years. One very early in my career as a crime writer, when I was writing a series set in Liverpool about a Liverpool lawyer, and I call that It's Impossible. So all the stories had titles from 60s pop songs.
Nice.
So there's a Perry Como reference there. But I've never been brave enough to venture a lottery mystery novel. But I think that if one's trying to write a lottery mystery of substantial length, a novella or a novel, then you have to look at something additional to the puzzle, because the puzzle by itself isn't necessarily going to sustain a book in the modern era. So you are looking, as I say, I think that that George Limnelius did it very well with the Medbury Fort murder. I think you are looking at that mix of character and setting as well as the plot, and trying to integrate them together. And that's really what appeals to me about the best crime fiction, that the finer examples do tend to have all three ingredients. Now the precise blend may vary, often does,
of course.
But they're all present to some degree, I think, and that's what I'm aiming for as a writer myself.
Could you give us some examples, putting you on the spot, of novels particularly that you think manage the locked room, the impossible crime setup, especially well. You've already mentioned that obscure novel, The Hollow Man, by the forgotten John. John someone.
Yeah.
Are there any other novels that, if you think, you know, this is a particularly good example, this is a particularly well-rounded example of the impossible crime in novel form?
Well, I think John Dixon Carr did write, quite apart from that particular title, quite a lot of really good ones.
Oh, yeah,
and his great strength was that the atmosphere creates that setting. So even in the very early ones, like The Waxworks and so on, with Benkelin, it works really well to create that spooky, mysterious, bizarre mood. Something slightly off kilter, which fits in, I think, with the nature of a locked room mystery. It's you know, that in real life there aren't that many locked room mysteries, but in fiction it works very well if there's something slightly baroque about it. And again, if you think of Agatha Christie, probably the best one, certainly in novel form, is Hercule Poirot's Christmas, which is a very strong Poirot, I think. And again, that idea of all the blood, the way that's worked into the storyline, I think she did it very, very effectively.
That's really interesting in terms of the way you've combined puzzle and mood, or puzzle and setting, puzzle and character, because you're right, one actually feeds the other and then reverses and feeds back. So as you say, Carr does that so brilliantly. You've got this great puzzle that's so intriguing, but it's maximised by the setting. Then the setting is maximised by the weirdness of the crime, and they feed each other and the intensity grows. So you're right, there's something about balancing those. We've been talking recently about this idea of the too good to be true factor, where a locked room writer focuses so much on the setup that it's so watertight, there's nothing of intrigue anymore because it's so obvious what's going to happen. And then if the characters and setting aren't there, the puzzle isn't enough, like you said, to carry it, because it's falling down in its, that it hasn't been lifted by the setting as well. Yeah. I think that's really intriguing.
That's right. And if you think of Jonathan Creek, which in many ways was one of the finest modern examples, albeit on television.
Amen.
The way that David Renwick combines those elements and adds the humour as well, I think is quite brilliant.
Yeah.
We've recently got some Noel Vundry translations from John Pugmire's Locked Room International, and The Howling Beast, I maintain, is, for in terms of just maintaining the atmosphere and the way the impossibility comes, it's very late, which is the only thing. I think a lot of people may have lost interest waiting for it by that point, but the way the impossibility comes out of the very small cast in that very baroque atmosphere, it's one of the most beautifully organic and like one of the most striking impossibilities I think I've ever read. Even though it is technically quite a minor aspect of the book and very late on, but I think Carr does it brilliantly with like The Reader Is Warned, for instance, which we have spoken at length about before. That's all I was going to say.
I guess. Well done, great finish.
Thank you, well
said. Well said, mate.
Thank you.
I guess it's interesting for me as well in that we, in the last few episodes, talked about our 10, what we thought were the 10 best impossible crimes. And I didn't go down the what I thought were the best, because that's an almost different list to what I actually went down, which was the ones that stay with me the most, the ones that continue to haunt me, is what I called them.
Yeah.
And there is an interesting thing where you could have a wonderfully brilliant puzzle with a great solution, but it's trapped in a terrible story, you know, and then you can have something that maybe not the most original, but the whole haunting atmosphere of it just sticks with you more than something that would be brilliantly constructed does. I mean, an example of that is, I think, is The King Is Dead by Ellery Queen. Such an interesting setup, which could be so brilliant, but I find the story so dragging, droll, and then the solution itself is kind of one of those frustrating, we searched everywhere except for this exact bit, which we didn't mention, you know, and it's like trapped, something's trapped in a bad story, I think,
Yes, well, originality is really important, but at the same time, it's very, very difficult to be original. And so the originality is sometimes in the way that you approach the material. So if you're writing a novel now, I think that it's very hard to do something that nobody else has ever thought about, but there are still fresh ways of writing, and writing either very contemporary mysteries or mysteries in a more classic vein.
To that extent, how proud do you feel, talking about originality, how proud do you feel that your story, Waiting for Godstow, was included in the Black Lizard Book
indeed.
Of Impossible Crimes by Otto Penzler, not just included in there, but included in a category all of its very own,
because he
lumped them together, so they're all very like, and then you get your own entirely original category at the end.
Well, was a subtitle which some stories just can't be categorised.
Very
memorable, that's the story that haunts me, that's a good example of that, actually.
That's a story I had great fun to write. I originally wrote it for an anthology edited by Mike Ashley,
and so
I wrote it quite a while ago, and then I was very happy with it, and it was published in that anthology, and then Otto came along, one of the great experts on the genre, and as you say, put it in a category all of its own right at the end of the book. So I was absolutely thrilled with that, and it's the sort of thing that it's one of those happy moments you get as a writer that's really really quite exhilarating.
Did he say to you at the time, "I just don't know what to do with this"? Or did that
come
as a complete surprise?
Yeah.
It's like, Martin, I'm so sorry. I do not know what
on
to
earth
do.
Is this?
I got to know him reasonably well. I'm still in quite regular contact with him as a result of that, and it's been great fun. And also, of course, as we said before, sharing information and experiences. And of course, he's met all the writers over decades and decades. So it's been a really joyful experience.
So again, coming back to your own writing, your own work, the story of classic crime, 100 books, is coming out in paperback soon, so do grab that, listeners. And you mentioned to me a little bit in passing today that you're working on a new novel, it's coming out in September, and it does have a locked room angle as part of it, am I right in saying that?
Yes, it's time for me to get back to fiction. I've been working on this book for about 3 years, so it's been a very important project to me whilst I've been working with the library on the classic series. And I decided after The Golden Age of Murder and after being involved with the library that I would try something completely different. So I would write a novel set in 1930, but I would write it completely differently. So I would write it without plotting it in advance in the way that I have done with my earlier books. I've always known the resolution before I started. This particular book, Gallows Court, I decided that it would be a different book entirely, not just in terms of the period. It would start with a character and a situation. A woman comes to London, fabulously wealthy, rather mysterious, becomes involved in a bizarre sequence of murder cases, and one of them does indeed have a locked room angle, although it's not a locked room mystery as one would conventionally understand it. And one of the background ideas of the book was, because of my love of Golden Age fiction, although this isn't a pastiche whodunit, it's more of a suspense novel with a lot of plot twists. One of my ideas was to have a lot of hat tips, if you like, to Golden Age fiction. So there's the locked room angle, there's a secret passage, there's a cipher, there's a Chinese character.
just the one. Just the one.
That's great.
And all that kind of thing. So that was great fun to to weave in. It was hard work to write, but I'm very excited about it because I've found a wonderful new publisher and Head of Zeus, and they've got great plans for it. So it's really brought me around full circle, and I think I have to say it's the most exciting moment of my writing career to date.
That sounds
so
fantastic.
Exciting.
Out of interest, when you say you didn't plan it out in advance, did you write it on a very kind of a gut feeling way, or did you adopt the sort of Earl Stanley Gardner plot wheels, roll a dice, see what happens next?
No, I was very taken with this central idea of the character and the situation, and I decided to experiment by writing a Golden Age short story featuring the character, which I wouldn't publish, but which was a way of testing out my love of the character and how keen I was to write a whole book and spend a long time in the company of that character. And I wrote the short story, I was happy with it. I've done nothing with it, but it fired my enthusiasm for doing the work. And it was a lot of work, but it was, in the end, it's proved really exciting.
That's fascinating.
Well, Gallows Court, September 2018. Look forward to reading it.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Martin, it's been an absolute joy to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time, especially after a crazy last few week of events that you've been jumping around on. And we hope to welcome you back again.
I've loved it. Thanks for inviting me.
Anytime you like. Anytime you're in London with a spare half an hour.
Come across.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
So we've been the Men Who Explain Miracles. Thanks again for listening. My name's Dan, and I blog at The Reader Is Warned at WordPress, so you can follow me there.
My name is Not JJ, and I blog at The Invisible Event, where you're probably listening to this.
And I'm Martin, and I blog at Do You Write Under Your Own Name on Blogger?
Because no one's ever heard of it.
That's right, you'll be famous now.
You're famous,
you've done our
this.
Podcast. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.